Hey everyone, welcome back to Historical Friction. This is a podcast about how we experience the past through pop culture and media. And today's episode is the second of a two-parter about representing the plague. My name's Alice Proctor. I'm an art historian and writer. And for this episode, my guest is the same as last week. I am joined again by Sarah, who was a fantastic person to discuss the Seventh Seal with, and then made me watch a film called Black Death, which is truly not comparable. A little bit of housekeeping. As always, you can find the show on Twitter at History Friction, and you can find me there as well at AA Proctor. If you want to support us on Patreon, that makes a huge difference, and the link is in our Twitter bio or at Historical Friction on Patreon. We are really grateful for any support that you give us, and that includes just listening to the show and telling your friends and stuff like that. And with that, let me introduce you to the episode. Welcome back. We are doing the second part of our Plague 2-parter. Last week we watched The Seventh Seal. This week we are talking about a 2010 sort of horror film, mostly just really gory, weird film called Black Death, which is very, very different to what we watched last time.
Yeah, it's a Sean Bean vehicle that starts with an old-timey font saying 1348, so we know when it's set. There's a voiceover that starts with a really profound misunderstanding of how medieval Christians understood the causes of the plague, and then it just kind of goes downhill from there. Because it begins by talking about how this all was caused by sort of demonic possession or demonic causes, which is not really accurate.
Right. So, yeah, it's this classic trope of like, ah, yes, we are being punished by God, and therefore we have a plague, which, like, yes, that is part of the understanding of how, like, disease is conceptualized historically, but very specifically in this case, they're talking a lot about, like, devils and demons and things like that in a way that just doesn't really seem, oh, I don't know how to even describe this. It's very, there's something very satanic panic about this film.
Yeah.
It feels like weirdly 80s in a way.
Yeah, I feel like they are trying to grapple a lot with just, like, what is the most gruesome thing that we can imagine? And it is this.
So we start, one of our main characters is Eddie Redmayne, that fucking guy, playing a monk who has been having an affair with a peasant woman. He's a little novice and he's been hooking up with a girl called Avril. Is this going to be one of those, like, Tiffany's actually a medieval name things? Because I just found it really funny that her name was Avril.
I don't know. It might be that Avril is a name, but I think throughout this film, there are just all of these, like, sort of made up medieval names, and you get the feeling, or it feels like when watching it, that medieval people were not allowed to have names with more than one syllable unless they're a main character.
Yeah, so Eddie Redmayne is playing a monk called Osmond. Sean Bean is called Ulrich. And the others in the group are Wolfstan, Griff, Dallywag, Mold, Ivo, and Swire. These are just such, like, random names. And in the village where they go in the end, which we'll get to in a minute when we talk about the plot, our character's called Hob, and Langiva?
Sure.
Sounds contagious. So the plot of this film is, it's such a romp. It's so, like, hit the notes of all the tropes and use it as a frame for what wants to be, like, a horror drama but doesn't really have much stamina to it. The film starts with Avril fleeing the village because the plague has come, and Osmond promising that he will meet her in the forest in a few days' time. He then meets, after having a conversation with God, where he's very, like, direct about what he wants. It's very, very, I want to say post-Luther conversation with God going on here.
It's a very personal conversation.
Not very 14th century. Yeah. he meets Ulrich, who is one of the bishop's men, who has come with his little posse to ferret out this apparent necromancer in the village, because one of the towns, mysteriously enough, has not been touched by the plague. So right from the start, we have this sense of disease as being kind of somehow demonic, somehow unholy. We have this group of men who are soldiers who've all fought in wars and things like that, who see themselves as on this kind of like holy quest to go to the village and torture people and find the necromancer or whatever to explain why this plague has not been touched, this village has not been touched by the plague. Osmond agrees to go with them as a guide. Whilst he's there, shenanigans ensue, and
yeah,
it's just
like, the thing is, the plot, it's simultaneously too complicated to explain, like, if or if not there are zombies. But yeah, like, he goes to the village, it turns out that they are like some sort of murdering pagans there might have been, and they start torturing the Christian torturers that came to kidnap them, and in the end, like, only two of them survive, and they have, like, most people in that film have died in very, very gruesome ways.
And this is where I feel like the sort of the Satanism of it feels very sort of 80s, 90s, and the kind of representation of non-Christian, quote-unquote, pagan people feels very satanic panic in a lot of ways, because the ultimate goal of virtually everyone in this film is to do some torture. And there's something very strange about the representation of this village, and particularly of the woman who sort of leads the village, Langeva, who her main desire seems to be to, like, punish the Christians for some reason, and there's never really any sense of, like, why she wants to do that.
Yeah, there's, like, a throwaway comment about, like, how her husband had been murdered by Christians, but no, like, explanation of how or why you have this little village of, like, a non-Christian outpost in the middle of an English forest.
Yeah, and she's, you know, supposedly bringing people back from the dead. She persuades Osmond to sort of believe in her powers by apparently finding Avril in the forest and drugging her and staging a resurrection, which, it doesn't really make any sense. Like, is this to keep the people in the village sort of in her sway? Is this just for his benefit? Like, does she just get off on it? It's very, very weird.
It was that scene when she is being brought back from the dead. That's when I realised that I had seen this film in the cinema when it first came out.
Oh my god!
And then subsequently, like, repressed all of those memories. Because I didn't remember any of the things that happened before it. Make of that what you will.
Yeah, so let's talk about what this film... This film thinks it's doing something really cool and exciting by showing us, like, the real side of the Middle Ages. And I found this quote from the director that I just want to read at length because it's so insightful into, like, what the fuck was going on in his head. It's a medieval guys on a mission movie, the period of the Black Death. What's fantastical and rich about that period? I said, what if we took a realistic approach? This is not a realistic film, like, get out of here. The people of the time believed the plague was sent by God to punish them for their sins or by the devil to torment them. I wanted to find out what the characters felt and posit them on a journey of, is this real or is it not real? What would a necromancer be like if he existed? We added this fundamentalist knight, so it touches on fundamentalism. It's a super dark film, but it's exciting. It's like a dark parable about how things haven't really moved on in the last 600 years. It's not that deep, bro. It's just some guys and some swords.
Yeah, and there are all these things, like, in the beginning when they set the scene, there are just, like, dead bodies everywhere. And they're walking through these churches, and, like, you have these, you have a real sense of that the death is upon you and it is really grim. But... And that's, you know, I think that's actually quite, like, not that I think that accuracy is, like, the most important thing, but that's, we have this sense from chroniclers that people are talking about, you know, if there will be people there left to bury the dead, and there are so many, like, the bodies are just piling up, we don't know how to do it, and, like, you know, will someone be able to finish writing this chronicle if I die? Those kinds of things.
Right.
But, what you didn't have, and so in that sense, like, that, I think that really grapples with that kind of the sense of despair and terror that people surely felt. And in that way, I don't really care that, like, you know, plague masks were not a thing that existed in England, especially not at this time. But what I do care about is that, like, you wouldn't have just sort of buried people where they fell or cremated them. Things like being buried in hallowed ground is actually was incredibly important. So the idea that, you know, I mean, especially if you have a fundamentalist knight, that all he cares about is, you know, his relationship to the church and to God, to then have him bury one of his men in the woods, just where he falls, pretty much.
Yeah.
It doesn't even fit in with the character that they have created, because the kind of fundamentalism that he describes is, like, out of step with what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that I think is, it's really important to understand, like, in the context of the sort of the trauma of this time. You know, so much of the writing and the documentation that we do have from the 14th century is talking about death on this kind of grand scale. Unfortunately, in the hands of a director making a film, that means that you just see piles and piles of bodies being dropped wherever. But it doesn't really show the kind of reality of it, which is that there is the creation of mass graves in order that people can be buried on hallowed ground without having to conduct individual funeral services and things like that. And that even in the face of, like, a huge amount of death, the rituals surrounding burial, grief, mourning are still being considered. You know, it's not as simple as chuck them in the forest and it'll be fine. Like, there's still a protocol around funeral rites that exists at this time. And that obviously doesn't make for as exciting cinema as, like, oh, look, there are just graves everywhere.
Yeah, I think there would probably be a way to deal with that trauma, but I think it is more compelling to have people being cremated and to have people, like the dead being desecrated in all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. Makes for a more compelling image of like a really horrendous past. That's not quite accurate.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that, I mean, like, it doesn't escape me that we're talking about films that represent the plague, like, in the context of a global pandemic. Like, there is something to be said for how humanity and, like, the cultural West tries to ignore death, even when it's very tangible. And that's something that I think a lot of people have had to come to terms with over the last 2 years. Not to be obscenely topical, but, like, there have been images and discussions of what happens when you can't bury the dead fast enough. You know, I have friends who are in the States who are finding things that, like, the rate of cremation is causing catastrophic smog and things like that. And we do still have this dilemma now of, like, how do you respect the dying when there's such a kind of speed and fear around it? And that's something that I think, you know, this film being made in 2010, like, there's a sense of casualness around death that is very true to me of the most of the 20th and 21st, well, that particular era of the 21st century, the sort of 2000s, like, that represents death on a grand scale in a very, very casual way in film and in media more generally. And that is something where this film kind of falls short for me, because it means that you don't really take it seriously.
Yeah, and I think there's one of those things that's really striking with that quote that you read out, that, because he finishes it saying that not that much has changed in the last 600 years, right? But things that have changed are, like, are quite fundamental. Like, so there are things that are similar and there are things that are different, but the things that are, like, this casualness around, like, people dying and, like, burial rites is definitely a thing that is, like, more of a modern invention.
Yeah, completely. So we've already mentioned that, you know, there are plague masks and things like that. Let's talk about witches and the necromancer sort of subplot that's going on here.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are several encounters with witches in this. It starts with just a crazed mob but are about to burn a witch, and Eddie Redmond intervenes, and then Sean Bean takes her off. And I felt like there was a real echo of the Seventh Seal here, where like the knight takes her off to decide, but whereas in the Seventh Seal, Antonio's block like gives her some herbs to dull the pain while she burns. Sean Bean just stabs her in the stomach and leaves her for dead, because there was nothing else he could have done, because they would just have chased her down anyway. And they are also on their way to find the witch, obviously, and then the sort of plot twist at the end is that Osmond, having survived all this, renounces his membership of like whatever order he's a part of, and takes up the sword, and then goes around and like tortures women and like has them killed because he thinks that they are all witches,
and becomes a very, I want to say, 16th, 17th century kind of witch hunter.
Yeah, it does that thing that happens a lot in this film where it sort of flattens history, where it could, it says that, it tells us straight up in the beginning that it's 1348, but if they hadn't included that, and this had just been any plague, and it had just been any other year, then it would be sort of almost more forgivable to have it ending with a witch hunt on that scale. But it doesn't, like, they have positioned it very like clearly at one point in history, and then that doesn't lead to large-scale witch hunts. That's not a thing that happens in Europe for like another like 100 or so years.
Yeah, and that's something where like, yeah, obviously we're not devoted to accuracy on this show, but I do find it really interesting that generally speaking, you know, in films of this kind of old-timey, bad time kind of genre, we often have this very like generic understanding of the past, where it's sort of like it's somewhere between about 1300 and maybe 1550, and like there are candles, and also people wear like vaguely old-timey clothes, and you know, the women have modern hair, and the men don't look like they've washed for 6 months. And that's like this kind of generic old-timey vibe that the film gives us, but at the same time it's trying to be sort of historically specific. And I do honestly feel like they could have just cut that date from the beginning and I would have been much more like, eh, whatever about the whole thing. But giving it this specific location means that the rest of it feels just a bit weird.
Having watched the film, what time of year do you think it is in it?
Oh my god, like damp. It's just damp. Like, it's the season of misery. Because none of these films exist, like, within a real time. It's sort of kind of autumn, but, like, there's mist. It seems very cold, but also people aren't wearing very many clothes. Like, who fucking knows?
Yeah, that was one of the things that I found really, like, because when it said 1348, I was like, right, so plague arrived in England in Bristol in, like, around August in 1348, and then travels, because people didn't travel super quickly, it gets to I think York, it's in the spring next year, so it's quite a slow progress. So but because there was that date in the beginning, I was like, oh well, I should be able to like we should be able to locate this.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, like, we should mention also that this is very much not filmed in England. This is an incredibly not English landscape throughout the whole thing. It's filmed in Germany, I believe, and it's, like, got caves and marshes and things like that that are just so far from English that, yeah, it's interesting that they sort of seem to locate it in England whilst also very much not, like, they could have just said somewhere in Europe, you know, they didn't have to give it this specificity, but because they've given it specificity, we're going to pick holes in it.
Yeah, and there's like other things as well that I wish that there's a sense of timeliness that's really lacking, because if you start with a monk, you know, like what feast days are around this time, like what are the things that he is like his entire life would have been dictated by times when he was praying and specific feast days and specific celebrations to saints and these kinds of things. And they're like, they frame a person's entire life, and this would be true for literally any character in this film, but that's completely lacking because all we get is this date. And that's the only thing that matters.
Yes. Yeah. It's probably too much to ask considering all the shit that's going on in this film. But I do always appreciate when directors, filmmakers, writers have a sense of the contemporary understanding of time of their characters. Like, do you mark it by feast days? Do you mark it by seasons, by weather, that sort of thing? Like, have a sense of how people experienced time. You don't have to be super accurate, but if you have an understanding of, like, what the shape of the day feels like to people, you know, that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, like, is this during harvest, the harvest? Is this, like, are they going to be slaughtering animals? Are they just, like, waiting to be able to plant things again? Like, these are, like, that's completely alien. Like, you have just have this, yeah, it's just very damp.
Yeah, and no one's doing any farming or anything like that. So let's talk about how they represent plague in this. Because very differently, you know, with the Seventh Seal, one of the things that we talked about is the fact that the sort of the illness is mostly off screen. It's this kind of ghost that's haunting all the characters. People are aware of it. We do see one person die. But generally speaking, the illness is not sort of present amongst the characters. Whereas in Black Death, it's basically the main character of the film.
Yeah, and obviously it starts with like a couple of rats running across a corpse, so we know what's going on.
Yep.
I think it's really interesting that there only seems to be one symptom, and that is that you develop boils in your armpits, which is a symptom of plague, but is, you know, it's preceded by fever. And one of, I think, for me, really haunting, like, late stages of plague is, like, the hiccups. I don't actually know if that...
Oh, my God.
Right? I don't know if that's a thing that people are... if that's still a thing. Like, obviously now it is very treatable. But that's a thing that you find from reading chronicles, is that, like, late stages is, you know, described as people having really severe hiccups and that being... like a symptom that death is near. You know, I'm not saying that they should have, like, included all of those things, but if you're making a film that is supposed to have, like, have these very accurate representations of what the boils look like, how are they walking around with that pronounced, like, late stages of the illness? Like, twice in the film, that seems to be the only symptom they have before being murdered by someone else, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, as someone who... I grew up very much on the sort of, like, horrible histories kind of representations of the Black Death and things like that, and I read a lot of those kind of plague year books that are always written for kids about how everyone's really sick and the main character sometimes survives, but the neighbour dies or whatever. And so, like, I'm very familiar with the kind of straightforward, most obvious symptoms of, like, you have a fever, you might be kind of delirious, you might be coughing, and then you have the swollen lymph nodes and the buboes and the kind of, like, big black lumps in your groin and armpits and things like that. And several times in this film we have really gross close-ups of the buboes and the kind of, like, swellings that people have, but there's never anything accompanying that. You're right, they are just kind of, like, walking around with lumps.
Yeah, and there's one character, so on their way to this village, and I think this character might be called Griff, but who knows.
Yes, he is called Griff.
He starts coughing, and they immediately accuse him of being ill, start looking at his armpits, and then he, like, confesses his, like, sins to the monk, and then someone stabs him to death in a sort of in a merciful act. I think it's such a strange thing, because on the one hand they all say, oh, don't go near him, don't go near him. And then they, like, rather than seeing if he'll recover, they just, like, kill him immediately. So they seem to have some sort of idea that it's contagious, but not, not enough wherewithal to think that they've just spent like several days in this man's company.
Completely.
And like, I think one of the things that's quite interesting about the Black Death is that there were so many explanations for what caused it. So, you know, you have astrological conjugations, and you have like God punishing people for, you know, wearing too tight clothes and for jousting, and so you have like for pretty much every person could have their own explanation for like what's caused it, and that's like quite interesting. But we do also have really sophisticated ideas about like contagion as well, and like for example, the word for quarantine comes from the Italian word for like 40, because that's the number of days that merchant ships had to wait off the coast. I think it was off the coast of Genoa before they were allowed to like come ashore in case they had plague.
Yes. Yeah. So there is this sense that like there is transmission, but there's also a kind of incubation period. Right. And so people have to quarantine for a while, and we do actually see at the beginning that Osmond has been in quarantine because someone thought he might be sick, so he's been hanging out in a monastic cell by himself for a while, and he checks his armpits and determines that he doesn't have any buboes, and therefore he's allowed to come out. And it's very confused in the sense of like people understand that it is contagious, but at the same time they don't really seem to recognize like how that might be, which doesn't seem to be very true to the time, you know, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I feel like one of the things about plague is that it dwarfs everything else, like all the other causes of death and all the other ways in which people can suffer are kind of overtaken by this like mass casualty event. But here it's just like plague happens and then these people just keep torturing each other.
Yes. Yeah, let's talk about torture, because this is a huge part of the film, is that they're bringing all of these torture devices to the village because they're convinced that there must be some kind of necromancer there. I don't imagine that there's much historical precedent for people going hunting for necromancers at this time. It doesn't seem very...
No, and I mean, and like, it's quite an interesting idea though, like that someone would, you know, like want to investigate like why have they been spared this like terrible fate and all of this stuff. They rock up to this village having left their like cage with them, which is like an Iron Maiden thing with like a very sharp blade in it as well. So like an Iron Maiden's are not a thing that existed in the Middle Ages. It is like most gruesome medieval things, a medieval Victorian invention.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, so they bring that along, pretending that they come in peace, having brought this like horrendous torture machine with them. But then, you know, the tables are turned and they get captured and they get like submerged in some sort of cold water tank that's constantly dripping water on them.
At this point, I wrote in my notes, like, love to hang out overnight in a weird pond, because I truly could not work out what was going on here. They spend, yeah, they're basically put in a very large puddle overnight to freeze, to be tortured, to be miserable. It's very weird. And the kind of, this film delights in torture in a way that I just find very boring.
Yeah. I think that is supposed to be like some sort of very primitive Chinese water torture type thing, but rather than it being like one drop on the same part of your face forever, it's like just a bunch of dudes in a trough under like
5 feet apart because they're yeah, it's just a bunch of guys in a bucket 5 feet apart because they're fundamentalist knights. It's very weird. And then we do see that the people of this village have somehow managed to get the Iron Maiden and other torture devices over the marsh, which the knights failed to do, which again is obviously never explained, and use that to persuade the villagers that these people mean them harm and therefore it's okay to kill them.
Yeah, and I think there's also, it turns out that they think that the reason they've been spared the plague is that they keep sacrificing Christians through some like very very gruesome crucifixions and like other types of torture. It is.
They're sort of like praying to the marsh as well to be like, we'll pour loads of blood into you, keep us safe. It's very weird.
Yeah, and I think it's supposed to be that everyone is a bad person and no one is good, and therefore, like, we just delight in this bloodshed.
Yeah.
But that's when we come back to that point again about, like, quite a lot of things have changed over the last 600 years. And I think by, like, taking all of these things, like, from history, so taking by, like, the witch hunts and the Iron Maidens and the crucifixions and the water torture and all of these things that, like, different torture techniques that span, like, thousands of years, and they're all happening in this narrative in England, in rural England, in 1348, it has this effect of flattening history. So it just is the past where everything was bad and people were torturing each other for absolutely no reason. And then there is the present where, you know, not much has changed, but, you know, like, some things have fundamentally really changed anyway. But it's just, we have this dichotomy between the past and the present, and where at least, like, things are bad now, but at least it's not as gruesome as it was then.
Yeah, at least it's not as muddy as it was then. One of the things that, like, really stood out to me is that this is not a good script, and it's not a great concept, but you could make a kind of psychodrama out of the essential structure of this plot. You know, if you have the sense of people being deeply afraid, deeply paranoid, you have this kind of isolated village that's mostly escaped, it could be a really interesting, more of a kind of thriller than horror, you know? There's some elements of claustrophobia and intensity around, like, what's the right thing to do, will your faith protect you, kind of thing, that there's just no subtlety to this film.
Yeah, and there's just, like, it's very, very grainy. There's a lot of things that are very gross, but somehow... Yeah. Every single woman in this film manages to keep her, like, white linen shift dress completely clean. And there is, like, when they are having dinner in the, like, the village hall, I think it is, there's one wall behind them that's clearly just made up of sticks, but yet they have, like, a very fine, like, linen cloth that's, like, laid out on all the tables.
So funny. One of the things that, like, one of the pieces of dialogue that I wrote down from this that I just thought was absolutely fucking hilarious is when they're traveling to the village and one of the knights is telling little Friar Eddie that there was a town that burnt 128 witches in one night. That's 16 an hour for 8 hours. It's just like, I just found it so funny that there's this idea of, like, everything makes perfect sense. There's, like, 16 witches an hour for 8 hours. That's, like, we've got a schedule to get to here.
And as if, like, this is happening, like, during a person's work day.
Yeah.
Like, right? This is a very...
You gotta hit those targets. Those KPIs have to be met. And that's something where, like, one of the things about the Seventh Seal that came out that I found really kind of compelling is that we hear about all of these omens that people are getting, you know, but we never see them. And so there is this sense of the sort of anxiety and paranoia that's going on, like, two horses ate each other, a woman gave birth to a calf. They're all the classic, like, oh, there were four suns in the sky sort of thing. Whereas in this film, just, like, everything that could possibly happen that is bad, like, happens on screen. And it's treated very differently. Like, there's no subtlety here, there's no nuance here, there's nothing is left to the imagination.
Yeah, there's a lot of people, like, having limbs cut off and being decapitated, like, on screen. Sean Bean, like, ends up being torn apart literally by horses.
It's so nasty. And it takes so long to happen. Oh, it was awful. But yeah, as he's dying, he somehow manages to tell Eddie to open his shirt and shows everyone that he does in fact have the plague and he's brought the disease to the village after all. And that was such a letdown, because it's like, ah, yes, in the end, everyone will suffer because everyone will die, because everyone will get sick, because this is a contagious disease, rather than leaving any kind of room for the sort of weird supernatural of it.
Yeah, I was like, okay with, like, a lot of the gore and a lot of the weird stuff happening, until they, you know, kind of explained that she wasn't actually bringing people back from the dead. It just had, like, when everything ended up having a natural explanation and it was just people being cruel to each other for no reason.
Yeah, I really struggled with that. I don't know, I think you can play with paranoia and fantasy in a really interesting way. And, like, fuck, the last film we watched, death was one of the main characters. Whereas in this one, everything is sort of neatly tied up in the end, and there aren't any witches, it's just horrible, horrible men. And, like, there's no magic, it's just being a remote village surrounded by a swamp. Like, that is such a letdown. And that's why that quote from the director about how he wants to make it, you know, really real and really is so boring to me, because there's no sense of kind of atmosphere to it. And one of the things that I think is often most effective about historical films and historical dramas is when you leave room for the worldview of the characters that you claim to be representing. When you leave a sense of ambiguity about the truth of things, you know? This entire film, the main characters are either, like, weirdo fundamentalists or weirdo pagan Satanist murderers. And everyone is bad and everyone is horrible, but in the end we're told that all of them are wrong. Like, none of them are right about what is actually happening. And, you know, the plague is not being sent by God, it's also not being sent by the devil, it's not being kept away by sacrifices and murders and things like that, it's just that the village is far away from other villages. And it just makes the whole, like, so what, the last hour and 40 minutes were just pointless?
Yeah, well, I think it is meant to make us, as, like, scientifically minded modern people, feel...
Oh yes, we are enlightened. Yeah,
like, we're supposed to feel really smug because we don't believe all of these, like, stupid and superstitious things of the past. We are, you know, we know what's happening and we understand the reasons for this, and, like, it's religious fundamentalism is a cause of being, like, not enlightened or not educated enough. It doesn't have, like, religion doesn't have another function than providing answers for, like, a crisis.
And, like, yeah, we're smart enough that we spotted the rats at the beginning, you know? We know where the plague comes from, we know how things work, and that's fine, but it's just kind of, yeah, it's very smug, it's very boring, it's very white men making a movie in a way that I just don't have much time for anymore.
Yeah, and I think, like, a good example of that, like, okay, so it's incredibly unfair of us to be comparing one of the, like, you know, masterpieces of, like, cinema history with this. Like,
right.
They're doing different things. They're not supposed to do the same thing. One is a horror film and one is a, you know, like, a meditation on death and the meaning of life. However,
yes,
the way that the flagellants worked in this film and in The Seventh Seal, I think, is really representative of how the two films, like, engage with medieval subject matter in general. So in The Seventh Seal, they appear and it's very clear that they are a religious movement that's, like, trying to deal with a common trauma, and people are interacting with them, and it's a performance. So it's, you know, it's consciously interrupting another like people on the stage, and it's a part of, it's happening in a city or in a village. Whereas in this film, Sean Bean and friends meets a group of flagellants who are, like, moving through a swamp.
They're, like, walking in a river. It's really weird.
Yeah, and it's, like, there's no explanation. It's just them walking along the river. One of them goes off to talk to, like, a guy about, like, and he says, oh, don't go there, there's nothing up there, just death or whatever. Like, when I first saw the scene, I was like, it is quite a striking image to have a bunch of near-nude men, like, wading through a river, hitting themselves. Like, of course. But it's just used as this sort of medieval spice. Like, it's just a thing that's added,
yes,
to make it so that we can tell, like, this is a time of superstition and weirdness. It doesn't have an explanation, it's not rooted in, like, a worldview or an understanding of, like, a religious movement.
You could take that scene out of this film and not lose anything. And that's, it's, yeah, you're right, it's there as a kind of, like, little bit of local colour, like a little bit of spice to make it clear that, like, oh, by the way, people are really, really religious. And it's frustrating to me that something that could be, you know, part of this film, like, this is, yeah, this is not a great movie, but if your whole point is that, like, these knights are very fundamentalist and they're sort of obsessed with their own experience of faith, like, have them interact with the flagellants, have a kind of conflict of religion where these people believe that they're doing the right thing, but they're going about it in very, very different ways.
Yeah, or, like, have them interact with religion at all. Like, you know, there's one scene where Sean Bean is praying and that's it.
And the monk, you know, offers absolution to the one that's dying of the plague. He prays in English. Did you notice that? He says the Lord's Prayer in English as this man is dying. And I was like, come on. Surely a little bit of melodramatic Latin is the least I could expect from this movie.
At that point, I assumed that we were to think that everything that's happening in Latin. So I was like, right, this is fine. Because it's just happening in Latin. But then later on, when they're in the village and Sean Bean is offering to say grace in front of, like, all the villagers, he starts praying in Latin. And that was the first time I was like, oh, okay, so that is a different language from what they're talking.
Yeah, so, like, what is the truth? What is the language here? It's so weird. One of the things that I found striking about this film was, you know, yes, we're making a very, very unfair comparison between The Seventh Seal, which is a film from the 1950s. It's a very kind of artful film. It's very contemplative. This is a splashy 2010 horror film. But it is so, so striking to me to see the way that these two movies and directors are treating a very similar subject and what that tells us about the times that these films are being made in. You know, The Seventh Seal, as this 50s movie, has the kind of sense of contemplation of people who have survived, you know, horrors within their own lifetimes and have witnessed catastrophic events and how they live with the consequences of that in a really compelling way. And the character of the knight in particular is, you know, the man who's come home from war and is returning home and kind of brings death with him is really interesting, versus Black Death has this kind of remoteness from mortality, I want to say. And that sounds very kind of overthought and quite pretentious, but the kind of casualness of death and the sense that, like, war and conflict and death is something that happens somewhere else is so 2000s to me.
Because there is references to battles in the Hundred Year War as well, where they are, where all of these people have been fighting as mercenaries and they are, like, comparing notes about these battles. But it's very much a feeling that that is, like, war was something that happened far away or in a different, in a different country. And now they've come home and, like, you know, they're facing a different sort of adversary, but war is not there present anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that, it is very 2000s to me. And we see that in the way that the kind of bodies are treated, that there is this sense of, like, death on a grand scale, but that everyone is a bit numb to it, and that everyone is sort of, like, watching people die but not feeling anything. We never see anyone really grieving except for Osmond, and that's because he thinks that the woman he's in love with has been brought back from the dead, and he's sort of having more of a religious crisis than a personal one, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some sense of him supposedly grieving when he, like, finds her bloody clothes in the in the forest. All of these men who, you know, have been fighting together for years and years and years, who know each other really well, they just, like, are quite, like, they seem quite resigned to, like, all of them just dying from, like, illnesses that people, like, did recover from. Whereas The Seventh Seal is very much a film about, like, feelings and feelings about death and, like, a person's, like, role in life and stuff. This is just a film about dying, but no, and, like, being tortured, but there's just no,
yeah,
there's no sense that that has, like, an emotional import of any kind.
Yes, absolutely. Which I don't know, I found this film very tiring to watch because so much happens and also nothing happens, and people are sort of yelling and angry and having all their feelings, but at the same time they're also like completely emotionless. And the delight that people seem to take in sort of torture and death in this film is very disconnected to me. I think in particular, Karis van Houten is the woman who plays the sort of witch of the village, and she's doing exactly the same role that she then did in Game of Thrones, basically. She's just in a blonde wig this time, and she's sort of leading people to darkness and sin and things like that, and, you know, very obsessed with this idea of having a kind of like personal fight against the Christians that surround her. And I found it really interesting that there's never any sense of like what the other people in this town believe in and what their kind of personal faith is. You know, we see that there's this church that's been left to fall apart, but we never really have a sense of like how much people want to take part in these weird human sacrifices and things like that.
Yeah, and there is, I feel like there's a real missed opportunity as well. Like, when you have, if you have a fundamentalist knight who's just, who only cares about, like, God and the church, and then he encounters an entire village where all the women are, like, walking around with their hair uncovered, in, like, very, by, like, contemporary standards, like, quite revealing clothing, and they are, you know, like, his reaction to that seems very mild, if, you know, if his main thing that is that he is a fundamentalist and that's the thing he cares about.
It's, this film, I mean, it's just not good, but it does say a lot about how the kind of generic old-timey Europe sort of genre is used by horror and this idea of like torture and suffering and pain, and it is really this kind of like misery porn that doesn't quite tip over into the kind of like schlocky cult movie tone of things. And like, I think I would be a lot more forgiving of this film if it really like embraced the like gaudy B movie side of things.
Yeah, well, did you know that there is a film that was released like within months of this one, called Season of the Witch, which is the same. From memory, it's the same plot, pretty much, but it has, instead of Sean Bean, it has Nicolas Cage in it, so it's actually, like, fun.
Yeah, that sounds so much better and so much more, like... Yeah, I think with a lot of... The problem that I have with a lot of historical dramas is that they either take themselves far too seriously or they don't understand that it actually can be fun, and they fall into this weird dead space between being like a super serious, super accurate, sort of intense drama recreation of the past and just like just have fun with it. And so this film is sort of trying to tell us a big moral story about fundamentalism and faith and paranoia and things like that, but it's actually just like not very good and also takes itself too seriously to actually be fun.
Yeah, and the idea or vision of fundamentalism that's presented is so shallow and doesn't understand religious source material that it's trying to grapple with at all. So it just ends up saying that, you know, you the viewer are very, very clever for not believing in any of these things, as opposed to these people of the past who did all these horrible like torture stuff that's, again, just made up by the Victorians.
And it just lets you feel smug and self-important and like you know more than they do, and it means that none of the characters sort of have any kind of sympathy to them. The ending, the sort of little epilogue that's narrated by one of the two characters who survives, who's played by John Lynch, who I normally think is a very good actor. Like, he is really good in The Terror, he was good in The Fall, he's been in a few other things, and I think he is actually like quite a good actor. And this, he's got some god-awful bangs and he's just like got this really terrible part, but he gives us this voiceover at the end about how Osmond is so sort of traumatized by his experience that he becomes a witch hunter. And I found that such a letdown, that like this film doesn't grapple with trauma in any meaningful way. It's like, if you have been traumatized, you kill people. It's such a like basic understanding of what it means to sort of experience something traumatic.
I feel like there is that voiceover and I think it's the same voice that does the voiceover in the beginning that sets the scene. So it really like uses this to frame the film that in the beginning it's like we knew that this pestilence was something demonic, and in the end, you know, I think there's supposed to be like a sense of irony there that like the real evil was born from this trauma, whatever. But it just doesn't,
yeah,
like if it was just set in like some sort of generic European past and it hadn't said this is England in 1348, then you could just have,
yeah,
like gotten away with all of these things.
Or like go all out, make it an actual fantasy, you know, make it supernatural, make it demonic, have a sense of the kind of like impossibility of things, have some fantasy to it, instead of just being like, oh, by the way, everyone was wrong, we were the bad guys, everyone,
yeah,
sucks.
Yeah, like I don't want an explanation for like how people are rising from the dead. Like I just want there to be like an actual necromancer.
Yeah, right. Like just, if you're gonna give me all this shit about reanimating corpses, like give me the fucking zombies, give me the kind of ethical dilemma of what happens when you're surrounded by death and you can bring people back from the dead and yet you stay in your little village. Like what's the deal there? Like there is no ethical necromancy during a plague year. I just this could have been so much more fun, so much more interesting, but it's just some bros being dudes doing some torture. And it's just not good. Do you have any final thoughts on this? Is there anything we've missed? Anything that you want to like recommend for people off the back of this?
No, I mean, just don't, like, it's an hour and 40 minutes, and that's like a nice thing about it,
yeah,
is that it's not too long. But it's, I don't even think it's worth that, like.
No. I paid money to watch this film and I resent it. Okay, then a better question. If you were going to do a film about a sort of plague year, how would you do it? What would you do?
Oh, if I was to do a film about a plague year, I think I would like there to be just so much anxiety about what's happening and people like arguing about different courses and different treatments and but yeah, like very little showing of actual buboes and or another thing that I think is really interesting is like the large scale civic responses to plagues. So like the processions,
yes,
and the like, you know, it's a couple of years after the initial trauma of the first one, what happens when it reappears and like how are you trying to deal with that through like processions and through celebrations of specific saints and commissioning artworks of San Sebastian and like how do you respond to it within a Christian context?
Yeah. Oh, that's so much more interesting. Yeah, I agree. I'd love to see something that sort of is not the like first initial wave of plague and trauma and death and is more sort of about people who've maybe been through that and are like living with the consequences and having the sense of what comes next. So much more interesting, so much more kind of potential for something really fascinating and engaging if you have the understanding of like anxiety and fear that's surrounding people. Not, you don't just have to show people dying, you know, you can do something much more interesting if you don't actually show all of the deaths on screen, if there's a sense of the sort of like the grimness that can't be represented. I think that's so much more compelling.
Yeah, and I think there is a real sense of like the the way a society responded to plague in like in the years after it, when, you know, so many people have died, like what happens to your,
yeah,
like cohort, what happens to all the other like apprentices in a town, or what happens when there is not enough people to take in the harvest, and like,
yeah, absolutely. And like as someone, I read when I was an insufferable teenager, I read the Decameron and found it so interesting, and like I think it's a really interesting like text, but one of the things that I loved about it was the sense in which people are sort of trying to move away from this inevitability of like sickness, and they go on their little holiday to try and get away from it all. And that sense of like denial is really interesting as well. And the way that, you know, as in any period of history, as in any kind of moment of trauma on a grand scale, there are some people who aren't touched by it because they can afford to avoid it. And having that sense of kind of the desire to escape, not necessarily keeping you safe, is a really interesting kind of facet that I think is underexplored.
Yeah, and I think there's another element of that as well, and I think that's maybe something that we've found in the last sort of year as well, with a much, you know, less severe plague, but nevertheless, is that it gets really boring after a while. And
yeah,
like you start like living with the trauma, and obviously like so many more people died, and it was a much grander terror when plague first arrived, but then it became a part of like European life, and it just like it kept mm-hmm. reappearing in, you know, sort of like 10-11 years in between there were like localized epidemics. So how do you live with that? Like, you still have to, you know, people still had families, people still had parties, people still had, like, relationships.
Yeah absolutely. This film sucked, but this was a great conversation. Thank you so much for your time, for talking about two extremely different films, for creating the most unholy double screening. Like, just how did we put these movies together? This is so fucked. And if people want to find you on Twitter, where do they go?
Well, you can find me, I'm Tiny Red Book on Twitter.
And we're going to be, hopefully, hearing a lot more from you in upcoming episodes. I think you're going to be a recurring voice, and people are going to get to know you, and I'm really, really excited for you to be part of the like little family of the show.
Thank you for having me.
So thank you so much for listening. If you want to subscribe, that's the best way to make sure that you get all our upcoming episodes. We'll be back next Wednesday with the final of our little Halloween October spooky season movies. We're going to be watching The Witch. And I'll see you then.